As we heard during Rural News, China has once again been plunged into another COVID lockdown. And like before, it's already having significant flow-on effects. Shipping for agricultural machinery, wool and other bulk commodities has been delayed for the best part of 2 years. But the latest lockdown has created a global backlog, which makes previous delays look insignificant. Luke Radford spoke with Paul Zelai, the director of the Freight and Trade Alliance and the secretariat of the Australian Peak Shippers Association, to find out more.
Look, we've still got major congestion in ports around the world. You mentioned China, but also still off the coast of USA, off Los Angeles, still multiple container vessels there trying to deal with the volumes into the US. And then again, as you mentioned, China, you know, the rest of the world seems to have moved on from the lockdowns with COVID, but China is still going for this zero policy, and that's having some significant effects. We experienced it over the last few years with China. We had the global lockdowns back in 2020. In 21, we had Yantian and a partial close of Ningbo. But now it's probably worse again. Shenzhen, Tianjin, Shanghai are all suffering terribly now with these lockdowns.
When you talk about congestion in those ports, I suppose for someone that doesn't have a great understanding of the freight industry, can you explain what does that physically look like?
Well, again, we're quite fortunate here in Australia. Although we've experienced congestion here, we don't see vessels off our coast mounting up. The shipping lines will do like slow steaming to make sure that they reach a port and can get service rather than anchoring offshore. Off the west coast of the USA, for example, it's not uncommon to see over the last couple of years anywhere between about 40 and 100 container vessels just queuing up waiting to get into port. Now, that's not just an issue for the US. That then has flow-on effects for the global trade. And now we're seeing a very similar picture off the coast of China, you know, with Shanghai in particular. And we are a very small global world, really, when it comes to shipping. Everything has a flow-on effect. So we saw the issue with the blockage of the vessel and the Suez Canal. Well, that sort of fades into insignificance with the issues that we're seeing here now at some of the major ports.
So we talk about the flow-on effects. At the moment, what's, I suppose, the current state of global trade? Is there a number that you can give to sort of illustrate the delay at the moment, or is it all variable?
Look, it's all variable. And I think that, you know, the shipping lines will adjust accordingly. So they don't want to have their vessels at anchor just sitting idle. That doesn't help anyone. So we're seeing the shipping lines adjusting on the run, and they will bypass ports like Shanghai and even have blank sailings where they might just miss a voyage altogether just to avoid adding to that extra congestion. Now, that doesn't help importers and exporters. So any of your listeners who are waiting to buy their new lounge or get any other goods or services, you know, you could expect a further extensive delay. And then obviously trade is two ways. So our regional exporters will also be feeling the pinch as well.
Has a particular type of shipping been particularly impacted?
Yeah, the bulk hasn't been too bad. Our focus is more on the containerized shipping, and that's really been an issue now for the last 3 years. And, you know, in the lead up to the pandemic and then the last couple of years, just with the surge of imports, you know, again, when you cast your mind back to March 2020 and we started to hear about this virus and lockdowns, I don't think anyone really understood what it was going to mean. You know, we thought maybe we're going to go into a global recession or even a depression. But as it turned out, with all the stimulus funds and with everybody having still quite a significant disposable income, everybody bought things. In terms of shipping, it just went through the roof, and we still haven't really recovered from that situation. And these events that we're seeing now in China just add to the problems.
Paul Zelai is the director of the Freight and Trade Alliance and the secretariat of the Australian Peak Shippers Association, speaking there with Luke Radford. If you're interested in agriculture but don't own a farm, you might be watching strong grain and livestock markets thinking, how can I get a piece of the action? Evan Lucas is the chief market strategist for InvestSmart, and he says there is money to be made from investing in ag.
The easiest way these days to do it is to go onto the ASX here in Australia and buy through an ETF, an exchange-traded fund. There is some really, really good ones out there, and they won't probably be just directly cattle or just directly grain or wheat or corn or maize or whatever individual specific soft commodity you're after, they're more likely to be a package across all forms of agriculture. So agricultural chemicals, packaged foods, agricultural products, agricultural farming machinery, trading companies, oil and gas refining and all that kind of stuff, personal products. So it's unfortunately not specific. The other way to do it, there is a few individual stocks in Australia. So you look at something like GrainCorp is exploding because of what's been going on in the last couple of weeks.
What about A-REITs? Can you tell us about them? Is that something that's worth looking at?
REITs are always worth looking at. I mean, let's sort of bring out what the acronym is. It's Real Estate Investment Trusts. They are, you know, packaging together a whole range of real estate assets that you can then invest in. So that does mean that some of them actually pack up a lot of agricultural land. They pack up agricultural providers. They also tend to be looking at being the, you know, the landlords of things like processing plants. So you look at particularly dairy, a lot of the dairy processing plants are held in REITs that are then leased out to, you know, your Fonterras of this world or whoever it might be. So that is certainly another way to really look at it from an agriculture space.
Obviously, people should go get their own financial advice, but should everyday investors be looking at ag given this boom?
Yeah, and I will second that point. Obviously, I can't give advice on that idea. There is always an argument to be made that diversification is absolutely how you should be thinking. So unfortunately, in this country, when we talk about commodities, we sort of forget that our fourth largest export is agriculture. And we're one of the largest net exporters of agricultural products in the world because we're very good at it. And we have an incredible amount of space to do it. And we do it very well. Now, unfortunately, this year has been interrupted by floods. But if you actually have a look over the last 18 months, farming has been incredible in this country, absolutely booming. So there is every reason why you should be looking and always thinking about diversifying into areas that you may not have considered. And I would completely agree that agriculture should be part of it.
Do you feel that perhaps one of the reasons that investors, particularly young investors, aren't turning to agriculture is because when they're looking at ETFs, they're looking at things that perhaps align with their sustainability values and they don't see ag as moving fast enough in that space? Do you have any insight into why people haven't jumped on this bandwagon?
Because it's probably not sexy, I think is the better way to say it to you. And I know that's a little bit inappropriate to some extent, but agriculture is a traditional industry. And particularly when you look at sort of what's referred to as Gen Z or millennium investors, which I'll put my hand up, I'm a millennial in my space, but millennials are now touching 40. So we need to remember that in terms of where they're at. And again, it's probably not given the same kudos as what a lot of them are looking at and what you're referring to, which is fast moving places. So let's compare commodities with commodities. You look at soft commodities, what we're discussing right now in agro, with something like lithium or something like nickel. And then you can go into other asset classes, which from my perspective are also has a lot of risk. We know about the rise of cryptocurrency and they are very attractive to the investors that you're talking about, that young sort of investor, because it's young and shiny, it's fast moving and returns in their eyes are quick. Now, from my perspective, you should never be looking for a quick return, because if you're investing for a quick return, you are more likely to say, yep, possible upside, but you're going to see as much, if not more, downside.
Do you think we would have even had this conversation 10 years ago when agriculture wasn't going as strongly? Do you think we would have even gone, oh, should we be looking at that?
Probably not. And as you alluded to there, Eliza, you know, 12, 10, 15 years ago, we were going through pretty decent droughts and you know, grain prices were all over the place. Our grain wasn't great because of it. You also then had issues around supply and the kinds of supply. So they weren't getting the pickup. And then they have boom periods like we're going through now where they are. So it also shows that, you know, even unfortunately, soft commodities, they are a cyclical market with a cyclical movement, just like any commodity out there, whether it be iron ore, whether it be coal, whether it be copper, they all have their own idiosyncrasies that can move them up or down.
Is that what we should be warning people, that just because it's going up doesn't mean that it's a safe bet? I mean, yes. There's massive headwinds for every farmer every year. You mentioned the weather could be one. We've seen huge floods on the east coast of Australia. You know, we're only just recovering from the last east coast drought. Fertilizer prices are off the charts at the moment. There is a war going on. There's a pandemic. Are these things people have to take into account?
Yes, absolutely. And all of those factors are things that I would mention. I mean, right now, what is going on in the Ukraine is horrible, but also from a soft commodity reason, it's why it's moving there. I mean, I know your listeners will know this, but about 30% of global grain supplies come out of the Black Sea. So that is clearly been interrupted. It's not cut off. Some people think it's cut off. It's not cut off, but it is severely impacted. And that is when it's just simple economics. When you obviously cut supply and demand is roughly the same or slightly higher, it's going to drive the price up. So sooner or later, that will somewhat come back, or other players will actually soak up that supply and bring the price back down. Couldn't be us here in Australia. It's again comes down to, is this in my long-term investment profile? Yes or no. Does it fit what I want to do? Yes or no. Is it an area that I should be investing in? Yes or no. All those questions are what you should be asking as an investor. And again, I'll say it, Australians are very good at agriculture, and therefore that can be also a decent reason to be looking at it.
InvestSmart's chief market strategist, Evan Lucas, speaking to national regional reporter Eliza Borello about investing in agriculture, even if you're not a farmer. And let's stick with the investing theme, because much like the residential real estate market, the market for farmland is surging at the moment. The buying frenzy is attributed to high commodity prices and cheap debt, but all signs now point to the era of dirt cheap debt coming to an end. I wanted to find out how a rise in rates would impact the demand for farmland, and found out there was a bit more at play than just the costs of servicing a loan. Ben Craw is the Managing Director of Oxley Capital Partners, and I started by asking him just how hot the market had become over the last 12 months.
Yeah, thank you, Clint. So the farmland market we're seeing is very buoyant, driven by a number of underlying fundamentals, in particular favourable seasonal conditions, strong commodity prices, and obviously low interest rates. So that's fueling a lot of activity that we're seeing both in the domestic buyer market, so local family-owned or corporate-owned operators. And then we're also seeing, a lot of activity with some of that offshore capital coming into the space.
You mentioned cheap debt and good seasonal conditions were a real driving force behind the really buoyant farmland market. Nearly all predictions point to an interest rate rise or several of them coming over the next 12 to 24 months. So does that really have any impact on how that demand for this farmland might look like?
Yeah, well, farmland values are more likely influenced by a combination of factors. So higher interest rates, declining or flattening in commodity prices, and then seasonal volatility, in particular periods of drought, will influence farmland values. So what we would see, obviously in over 5%, the highest level since around 2001, but the market's already been pricing in over the coming months. So rising interest rates may curb buying power, but there's likely to be other factors that need to bind to influence, those land prices to what you talk about.
So it's not really correct to think about it in the same way as a residential mortgage stress as those interest rates rise, because it's a different, I guess, mix of factors at play here.
Yeah, well, you've got to look at it from a risk parameter. And when you look at, as I mentioned, seasons or cycles in agriculture, it's longer term. So to enter into a transaction, say, today with record high, call it red meat prices, if you look at the Eastern Young Cattle Indicator and you're going to, roll out the current sort of ecky price to sustain an investment decision, you need to stress test that and look at the sensitivities around what do you believe is a long-term sustainable average that will underpin, the productive capacity of an operation. And then that sort of plays back to, value parameters. And then you look at the land and say, well, on a summation or a comparable sale, what do you believe is relevant pricing? And then, as I mentioned before, the strategic rationale from investors vary. So one investor may say, well, look, we don't believe we could go any stronger. Another investor may say, well, this is the neighbouring farm. And when I say an investor, it might just be a family-owned operation that are looking at an investment. This is the neighbouring farming operation. We can bolt that onto our current platform. We can increase scale, increase overall capacity, and the economies of scale in that operation. So it's a little bit different to look at in that, and you've got to look at these investment decisions in the longer term.
You mentioned looking through cycles. Are we at the end of a one type of cycle where we're seeing a lot of the big corporate, especially overseas corporate investments that were made between 2013 and 2017 now passing into local hands? Is that one type of cycle that we're kind of seeing changing at the moment?
Well, there's been, obviously anecdotally, evidence in the market of some of those funds that have come to the end of their time horizon, Clint. So a lot of those are closed-end funds, so they may be a 7 to 10 year fund. So at the end, there's a liquidity event, and those assets, you know, obviously are traded. The positive about that we've seen is the depth of the local market, where some of those assets have been, you know, acquired by local family operations. And, you know, I'm an advocate for capital, whether that's offshore or domestic. I'm not, looking at this from a domestic sense, but it provides a lot more liquidity or depth in the market, and it's a rising tide. So it shows that investors, whether they're domestic, family or offshore, you know, pension funds, can come into the market and know that there is an exit strategy for them, with these types of assets that we're talking about. So I just think it's a positive that we're seeing there. And you know, the groups that we talk to from, you know, either the domestic or corporates locally or offshore pension institutional capital, you know, they see Australia very favourably. As I mentioned, you know, the ability to scale assets here locally, to chase economies of scale, low sovereign risk, strong ESG attributes. And then when they look at Australia in terms of relative value on a global stage, once you start to weigh up both, you know, non-financial and financial factors, Australia still comes out quite favourable. So there's a lot of appetite and a lot of money that still has Australia very much in their targets from offshore or inbound capital.
There are some headwinds. You know, we're hearing about high prices for things like fuel, fertiliser, chemicals. But otherwise, we do have these high land prices. There's been an incredible amount of moisture around the country. In the conversations that you're having with everyone, from people in that capital space to down at the farm level, is this kind of like an unprecedented good time in Australian agriculture?
It is a very good time. Typically, you would see very favourable seasonal conditions, which would mean a surplus of production, which may, you know, just a typical supply-demand balance, and your commodity prices, you know, may soften just through virtue of, you know, production. But what we're seeing is favourable seasonal conditions, high production, high commodity prices, low exchange rates and low interest rates. So, you know, all those fundamentals are pointing in the right direction. We've got a range of factors, you know, supply chain complications. We've got geopolitical concerns that, you know, from a macro level that really influence commodity pricing. But at the moment, you know, things are favourable. People are, you know, making a good run of it. And it's great to see that, particularly in the domestic space, you know, there's a lot of prosperity when you go into the regions. And you talk about the social fabric of regional Australia and regional, you know, towns. And when you get out into the bush, and it's, yeah, you can really feel it. And it's just a, you know, a really positive thing to see. And that will influence succession in terms of farm turnover, but it'll also influence younger people to come into the game as well.
Ben Crawe is the Managing Director of Oxley Capital Partners. My name's Clint Jasper. My thanks to Serena Locke, Kath McAllen and Matthew Sigley for their help putting Country Breakfast together this week. It's another Super Saturday, so stick around to find out what's coming up next here on RN.